WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Next Thursday night, the Voyager 2 spacecraft, launched 12 years ago, will pass by Neptune. Attached to the Voyager, almost as an afterthought in the planning, is a copper disc, a long-playing record that contains sounds and images of Earth. The music ranges from Bach and Beethoven to Chuck Berry and Aboriginal songs. The sounds include animals, tools, modes of transportation. The record was co-produced by my guest, the science writer Timothy Ferris. His books include Galaxies, The Red Limit, and his latest, Coming of Age in the Milky Way, which is now out in paperback. Ferris reports on science for the McNeil Era NewsHour and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley. With the sounds of the Earth recording, Ferris puts into practice a Taoist belief he holds that simple acceptance of the fact that you're a creature living in one wide world is considered enlightenment. You can study anything around and find that it's a link in a chain that reaches all across the galaxies. He's helped assemble a record that represents us, and this disc leaves our solar system next week. Should this disc ever be found and played, the first sounds will be greetings in over 140 languages, from Sumerian and Hittite to Hindi, French, Cetacean, Spanish, and Arabic.
Silema chemen.
Oitinis poteste chairete. Eirenikos prosphilos eleluthamen philoi.
Paz e felicidade a todos.
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
Those are greetings that are aboard the Voyager 2 that's just about to pass the planet Neptune. And it's contained on a recording that's affixed to the Voyager 2 spacecraft. The recording was produced by a number of scientists, including my guest today, Timothy Ferris. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
That was launched, what, about 12 years ago?
That's right, 1977.
Your particular responsibility in putting together that tape, that record that is affixed to the Voyager 2, was the music. But you and Carl Sagan and other scientists had to sit down and decide what it is you were going to send that represents planet Earth to people who might hear these sounds thousands and thousands of years from now. How did you narrow down your choice?
Well, the sort of criteria that we tried to apply were, first, that we wanted to have music from all over the world. We didn't want it to be just the Western society. And we wanted good music. We didn't want to put anything on the record that was unexciting, but that represented some sort of a politic choice, you know. We want it to be all to be good music. And it is, you know, an amazing business to listen to music from all over the world, much of it gathered in field recordings by ethnomusicologists and other pieces recorded in concert halls in Europe and so forth, and realize just how much marvelous music there is in this planet. It goes without saying we could have made 100 Voyager records and hardly have scratched the surface.
There are three different kinds of material on the record. There are the sounds of the greetings in, what, about 148 languages of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
There are then sounds of the Earth, and there's the music part that you chose, and there's also a section of pictures that are reproduced in the record. Could you talk a bit about the technological method that you used for putting all this on a disc, which I imagine is, what, the size of an LP record?
It's an LP record, recording at half speed, the old 16 and two-thirds speed that used to be used for talking recordings, language lessons, that sort of thing. Initially, the idea was that you would put a plaque on the spacecraft, and the first two pioneers did, in fact, have, you may remember, kind of a little plaque with a drawing of man and woman and a diagram showing where the craft had been launched from and so forth. When the Voyager project came around, and as further thought was put into this issue of, you know, how do you etch things into a plaque and how do you get a lot of information in there, someone realized that that's what a phonograph record is. It's just an etching. And if you make it out of metal, it'll last a long time. In the case of this record, more than a billion years of projected lifetime, which makes it the most long-lived object ever made. So it was that line of thought that led to the idea of a record. And music and sounds, of course, are natural to a record and have a wonderful kind of ambiguity to them in the sense that we think they might mean something to someone even when language does not. And then we found that there was a technique for encoding photographs acoustically as well. It was a recently developed technique. There are only a couple of machines in the world that could do it, and we were able to borrow one and actually encode both color and black and white photographs into the record, too.
Did you send along any kind of a record player?
Well, what they get, it would be nice if you could send an old wind-up unit, you know, just a little heavy. But we did enclose a record stylus, so that changes the wiggles into electrical information, and a set of diagrams as to how to play it, written in as universal a language as we know how to write it. The rotation time is in terms of what's called the transition time of the hydrogen atom, which is a universal constant. So one can play it. Of course, the question of whether what comes out of the record would mean anything, the music particularly, to an alien species is an open question, sort of a fascinating one, I think.
My guest today on Fresh Air is astronomer and science writer Timothy Ferris. One of the messages that's on this record is in both Morse code and Latin, two forms of communication that aren't used very much nowadays. But nevertheless, send a message. Whose idea was this?
We put together a mix of sounds of the Earth, natural sounds dating from geologic sounds through sounds of living creatures and then human beings and technology and so forth. And there's a little Morse code section in there, too, as part of a series of technological sounds coming up to the launch of a rocket, much like the one that launched Voyager.
Well, I think I'd like to hear this Morse code now. The Morse code sending out a message in Latin that says, travel through space with much difficulties.
Yeah, ad astra, ad aspera, if I remember my Latin correctly. There were plenty of difficulties involved in the Voyager mission. The record is kind of a lark, but the spacecraft itself, of course, is a very difficult engineering and technical feat to pull off. It's been spectacularly successful. But the record has no point whatsoever except it's just a gift. It's just there to tell you something about the people who sent the record. And that, in a way, represents art. You know, it's a wonderful sort of open-ended gesture. There's something appealing to me, at least, about the very pointlessness of it. It shows a certain flair that I like to think we have as a species.
The issue of sexuality kept coming up, and how you depicted the process of human reproduction and the shapes of men and women disturbed people in NASA.
Yes, it's the only thing that seems to have bothered anyone at NASA. You know, they sent some officials down to listen to the music when we had finished mixing it. And I remember it was a beautiful Sunday, and we were working in the CBS studios, and these gentlemen in drip-dry suits came down, rather grim-looking, and they listened to the music, to which they showed no particular response. It's some wonderful music. They would sort of listen to a little of each piece, say, oh, yes, yes, all right, go ahead. And really all they were listening for, I think, was to see if there was something had obscene lyrics. You know, it was sort of like the people who were monitoring heavy metal records these days for the same reason. And when they left, I went down with them to say goodbye, and there was a street festival taking place, as it happened on the street in New York where the CBS studios were. And all set up down the street were these booths with food and bands playing music and people dancing. And through this, looking neither left nor right, walking rigidly back to get a cab, to go back to the airport, to go back to Washington, were these NASA officials. Not exactly a fun-loving group. And they did object among the photos solely to a photo that showed a nude man and woman. It was an anatomical photo, and it had to be replaced by an outline, sort of a cardboard cutout, so that the extraterrestrials would not be offended by the sight of nude humans.
Which seems very odd, it being itself a scientific fact, but that's
well,
what I meant.
Of course, to be fair to them, what they really were concerned about was that some congressman was going to hold them up to ridicule.
Sending smut in space, I think, was the fear.
Yes, to be fair, they have a lot of experience with that sort of thing in Washington.
It's still a preoccupation of theirs, no question about it. There was a. You had some. You wanted to get sounds of human activities on the planet, and one of them was the kiss. You also had specific rules about the kind of kiss. The kiss had to be a heterosexual kiss, and it apparently had to be in certain configurations. And a rock and roll producer happened to be there and said, "Well, I can do a kiss into my elbow." And then you ended up, I think, kissing Linda Sagan's cheek.
Anne Droyan's cheek. We had an engineer working on the record named Jimmy Iovine. He's now been recommended to me by John Lennon and is now a leading rock producer. And Jimmy spent a lot of time trying to... I'll try to do what he did here. He would sort of go like that, trying to kiss his own arm, make a big smack. Never sounded right. And we wasted quite a lot of time trying to get a kiss. There weren't any, oddly enough, in all the sound effects libraries. There wasn't a good kiss. So I finally just gave Annie a kiss on the cheek up by the microphone that sounded fine. That's the one that went off into space.
And this is the one that somebody will hear some thousands of years from now.
Maybe.
That was it. Very short, just a little.
In isolation, it doesn't sound like much. If you play the whole mix of sounds, it fits in kind of nicely.
You added something to the actual master pressing of the record that's there with a heated ballpoint pen, something that you learned from John Lennon, what to do on a record where the label normally goes?
Yeah, the Beatles, I think, and John, after he left the Beatles, certainly used to etch little messages into what's called the takeout groove. You know, that's the part on the inside of the record where when the music ends, there's a groove that spirals in. And so with that idea, I wrote a little dedication in which reads, "To the makers of music, all worlds, all times." And when the finished record was delivered to NASA, there's an officer whose business it is to make sure that every part that goes onto a spacecraft fits specifications. You know, it's very important because if one part is wrong, then it can affect others and can cause trouble on down the line. And he rejected the record, and there was quite a period of some apprehension when they were threatening to send a blank disc instead of the record because of this failure of specifications. The argument that Carl Sagan made that finally swayed them was that this was the only sample of human handwriting on the record and it had some value. And for some reason, this made sense in bureaucratic terms.
Even though it wasn't in the specs. You were responsible for choosing the music that's on this disc. Frivolous though it is, it does seem for a lot of us who are not scientists to represent a wonderful kind of gift, as you've put it, to go out to outer space. You have Blind Willie Johnson on the record. How did you choose him?
I can't remember who found Blind Willie Johnson. It may have been me. I'm an old fan of blues music. We were naturally looking for music in which the music itself was of primary importance, the words less so, since language is obviously less universal than the music. And this wonderful piece, it was actually recorded in a field. It's literally a field recording. When you listen to the master, you can hear a freight train off in the distance. And it was a field in Texas, as I recall, by a singer so poor that he died not long after of pneumonia induced when he didn't have the money to find shelter for the night and had to sleep out with his wife in the rain and caught pneumonia and died. It's, to my thinking, one of the strongest pieces on a record full of strong pieces of music.
And we'll hear this. It's called Dark Was the Night. Blind Willie Johnson from Dark Was the Night, one of the selections that's on the LP that's aboard the Voyager 2. Understand, for this single pressing, you even had to pay royalties to some people.
There was a small royalty. It's a pretty small royalty when you've got one piece of music on a record of which only two copies are made, and they're both hurled off the surface of the earth. So brand new meaning to the term distribution. But yeah, I think it was necessary to send a few pennies or a nickel each to some of the people on the record. Some of them cannot be located. There is, for instance, a Peruvian song sung by a girl of about 16. There's also a recording of some pygmies in the Aturi forest doing this wonderful polyphonic singing.
Well, we have this pygmy sound. Was this something that you chose, or who worked with you on the folk music aspect, the ethnic music?
Alan Lomax was a great help in this, and it was he who came up with this this pygmy piece, as I recall.
Was recorded in the forests of Zaire with the pygmies.
Yeah,
of the
that's
Aturi,
you know,
forest.
That kind of polyphony dates back some 3,000 or 4,000 years. It's interesting that that's a form that was only discovered by the Europeans around the time of Johann Bach, but here clearly was going on a lot earlier. You know, it fascinates me that in the case of these recordings, we don't know who really the singers are, and we don't know whether any of them will ever know that this music was sent off into space as a representative of the whole world. I don't know whether they would mean anything to them particularly, but it was one indication to me of the fact that this may be one planet, but it still contains many worlds.
There are some curious anachronisms that are now on this disc, being 12 years old and out there. For instance, the greeting at the head from the UN Secretary General is Kurt Waldheim. Who I'm not sure would make it on a disc nowadays.
No, you know, we actually had discussions about the need to sort of denazify the record, and this goes to show how complicated things can be.
Would clearly nowadays there'd be other technologies to send far more material, compact discs, computer discs of one kind or another that could be read. Are there any regrets of material that you had to leave out because of that?
Sure.
Of the economy?
Sure. You know, it would be great to send a lot more stuff, but there is something refreshing about the discipline. There's only 90 minutes of music out of the 2-hour playing time of the Voyager record, and to compress everything to 90 minutes is invigorating. Compression is always a virtue, I think, in writing and many other things. It's not clear that any new technology would be superior. We're talking about something that lasts a long time here, and historically, that tends to be something that's etched into something solid. No one actually knows what the lifetime of a compact disc is, and if we were doing it again today, I personally would argue for doing just what we did, because we know it'll last. You know, a very interesting example of this is the people who are working on the prospect for a national nuclear waste dump somewhere in the western U.S., they plan to erect a monument over the site of this deeply buried dump with an inscription that says, "Don't dig down here, it's dangerous." And they have to communicate over tens of thousands of years, because that's the time during which this waste will continue to be hazardous. And they face many of the same kinds of questions. And when they did a study to see how can we preserve this information the longest, the answer was exactly the way the Sumerians did thousands of years ago. You make clay tablets, and you just chisel in, or while it's wet, you just etch in, as in the old cuneiform writing, your message. So sometimes the old technologies are still the best. Hmm.
The Voyager 2 was not originally scheduled to go toward Neptune. How did it end up there?
The whole Voyager project was a kind of a cut-rate project that was worked up after NASA's original request for a grand tour of all the outer planets had been turned down on the grounds that it cost too much money. The mission was to take advantage of a rare, really once-in-a-lifetime alignment of planets by which you can use the gravitational boost of Jupiter to go on to all of the outer planets, including Pluto. When that mission was turned down, Voyager was approved as a budget-saving mission that would only go to Jupiter and Saturn. But the mission planners were able to find a way to continue on, and they really at launch did not have funding to go past Saturn, but by the time of the Saturn encounter, they had made their case that they could go on to Uranus and Neptune, and they had scraped up the money for that. So in a sense, it's a shame that this magnificent mission was so pinched for money. But on the other hand, it's in the grand tradition of exploration. You know, explorers since Columbus and before have always been having to work hard to scrape up the money to put the adventure together. And that was true of the visionaries behind the Voyager project as well.
Will you be there at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory when the Voyager passes Neptune?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing here in Los Angeles now.
What are you hoping to see most? Do you have any expectations, or is it going to be utter astonishment for you?
You know, it's usually utter astonishment for me. Every planet in this mission has had such incredible surprises, and it'd be surprising if that weren't the case here. Neptune already looks like a rich and fascinating place. This is a genuine mission of exploration in the sense that, to some degree, you're testing existing theories, but you're also looking at, in an open-ended way, just wondering what one will see. It's the last great undiscovered planet. You know, as you and I are talking, we know very little about Neptune. If the mission continues to function properly, in a week, we'll know more than had been adduced in the whole history of humanity up until this time.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about a project that you've been working on, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Sid.